Welcome to season 3 of the Self-Care with Boosie podcast, a season that is all about unlearning and learning. As you listen to the experiences filled with unlearning and learning, may you uncover and unpack any limiting belief or thought you may be holding. With each episode that you listen to, may you uncover those beliefs or thoughts that don't serve you. Unpack and unlearn them so you can make space for new thoughts and beliefs that will move you towards being the best version of you. Today, we are joined by MP Peter Bolo, who is a Member of Parliament of Vaughan Woodbridge, and he is the Associate Minister of Mental Health and Addictions in the province of Ontario in Canada. So thank you for joining us, MP Peter Bolo.
My pleasure to be here this morning.
So now, mental health and mental illnesses affect a lot of us in a lot of different ways. And the impacts that mental health have on us, they can have very complex solutions that no one government can solve and have the answers for simultaneously. So as Ontario's first Associate Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, what have been some of the challenges that you've faced?
Well, one of the things that we found very early on, and it's actually something that's been seen in terms of the province, is the fact that our system is broken. Our system in the province is based on a lot of organically grown organizations providing services to people that are in need of mental health and addiction supports. And when I say organically grown, what I mean is the government has failed. The past governments have failed to build a comprehensive mental health care system to look after the needs of the people. So when I became the minister, one of the first things they said to me is, oh, you've become the minister of the orphan child of healthcare. And I didn't understand what exactly they meant, but what ends up happening is that mental health, partially because people don't like to talk about it because of the stigma associated with mental health and addictions for that matter, we don't talk about it, therefore we don't fund it or we don't need to fund it. And of course, if you are a mother or a father or a brother or a sister, and you have someone that's in need of support, what ends up happening is when you don't find that support, you end up creating your own organization to help that brother, sister, child. And what happens is that other people are pulled to you because they realize that you've started something that is filling a need that didn't exist before. The need existed, but the solution wasn't there. So in 2010, the past government did a study, a standing committee study within the parliament. And what they discovered was that there are several serious issues in the system. One of the main issues was accessibility to services. The second main issue was that there was fragmentation in the system. So that if you had the ability to get help from someone, that someone would then not be able to transition you to someone else, or that you would you'd be limited in terms of what types of supports were necessary. One of the things, so that's what was a problem that was identified. The connectedness within the system was a problem. Now, I realized that as part of my past work. I was a practicing lawyer, but I was also running a residential therapeutic community. And I discovered and I felt that those problems existed. And the very organization that I was with was one that was started by a priest, because a mother had called him wanting help, support for her son, and he gave her a phone number, or he started making an inquiry. He called the first place, who referred him to the second, to the third, to the fourth, to the fifth, to the sixth, and then the sixth referred him back to the first. So he went full circle, oh, wow. Found no support. And so was born this organization. My job, and I'm really proud to be the first associate minister responsible for mental health and addictions, because I understand those. And I've been on that side from as a service provider, trying to help people and being frustrated that the system doesn't work. So what I did as my first task was really traveled the entire province. I met with Indigenous communities in the far north. I met with rural communities east and west of the GHTA. I met with urban centers, and I started to get a feeling of the vastness of the problems, the gaps that existed. I started also to understand that you can't build a one-size-fits-all mental health strategy. Yeah. And I started doing roundtables in the Black community, in the Indigenous community, in the Francophone community, people with neurodevelopmental disorders and learning disorders, needing supports for learning. I went out and I met with different groups and had roundtables that were specific to each of them. And you know, when you sit around the table and you listen to, for instance, a roundtable with a Black community, you start to realize that there are special circumstances that need to be addressed, that if you're really going to help someone with mental health issues, you need to have service providers that are culturally sensitive to the needs of those individuals.
Definitely. So
that became the basis of the information that I received. And one of the fundamental aspects of the Roadmap to Wellness, which is the strategy that tries to address the issues of access and connectivity and fragmentation and best practices. So I started with that, was informed on it. And then the other thing that I realized is that a kid under the age of 12, if we can get to them early on, what happens is that we can deal with about 70% of the issues that will later be faced by that individual when he or she becomes an adult.
Yeah.
So we started looking at that and saying, what can we do for those kids under the age of 12? Well, of course, education and prevention, supports to the parents, dealing with issues of attachment, dealing with issues of socialization. And then, you know, the revelation of revelations, you realize that, for instance, in the Black community, a lot of the problems are as a result of the social determinants of health. The fact that we need to do better when it comes to healthcare in the Black community, physical health. We have to do better with housing. We have to do better to support education in the community. And if we do that and provide those opportunities to the young people, we deal with a lot of issues that are going to be dealt with properly, and we'll see that the community will thrive. So that became the focus of the next part of my study, was we've got to deal with the developmental lifespan of the individual. So 0 to 12 was my first focus, 12 to 24, 24 to 45, 45 to 65, and 65 and over. And then we looked at it and said, okay, if you're a Black person or an Indigenous person or a white person, and you're in the age group of 0 to 12, what is the step care model that needs to be put in place to provide as many services as possible within the community so that an individual doesn't have to go to another community to get support?
To get help, yeah. And I think there is a link between mental health and addictions, that if a person is not finding the help that they need, they might turn to other things and other ways to try and find help for themselves. That's not necessarily helping them in any way, but just makes the situation worse for them. So I'd like you to tell us a bit more about, because I think you've touched on a few things already, but just the approach that government is taking around mental health and addictions in the province of Ontario.
So based on what I've explained to you, if you were to sit back and you think, okay, well, what the minister is trying to do is he's trying to influence housing. He's trying to influence seniors. He's trying to influence special people, children with special needs, autism, so neurodevelopmental disorders. He's trying to influence education. He's trying to influence, well, I can go down the list and I can
point out
16 ministries that all have the thread of mental health woven within it. So in order to be successful, again, when we look at a biomedical model of care, we basically deal with the body, look at the physiology, give a pill and say, okay, you're going to get better if you take this pill and follow my instructions. But we know when we're dealing with mental health or addictions, it's much more than that. So we need to utilize a client-centered, holistic approach to help that individual, which means we have to build a model that has wraparound services, that has the ability to deal with the types of issues that also influence. And that really is the biopsychosocial model that has came in to replace the biomedical model. And what that means is that we've got to look at the individual not only from a physiological standpoint, but we have to also understand the psychological implications of growing up, of peers around, of attachment with parents. We also have to understand the social aspects of the individual as well. So where did he grow up? What type of friends? What type of education? How did he interact with other people? Were there influences in his life that or her life that took them off the path of wanting to be, you know, successful or a professional or, you know, continue education or find a job? What happened? And when you understand all those different aspects, you need to find a solution that's client-centered and focused on dealing with all the issues. That requires two things: service providers in the community to work together to provide the supports necessary to the individual, because the individual can't be put into the system and then forgotten. That person needs to be followed through the system. And the other part of that is funding from government. Governments cannot work in silos. Governments need to coordinate their efforts so that no one individual will ever be left out of the cycle. And I'll explain to you what I mean by that. Education, we just had all the kids go back to school, and COVID-19 is a huge concern. Well, investing in education and supports in the classroom, mental health supports for the children, that's great, because it could help identify issues that then need to be dealt with. But if you don't connect the piece to the service providers in the community through health, what ends up happening is the kid is diagnosed, he's assessed, but where does he get his treatment? And that same situation when you have it with neurodevelopmental young people, you know, up to a certain age, up to 18, they continue in the school system. They follow the curriculum and they're in education. When they become 18, they become adults. So where do they go from there? And how are they transitioned into a center, for instance, that provides day programming? And in some cases, you need to also have supportive housing. And how do they transition into that? So we need a lot of work in that. And of course, we're getting better at providing services, which means a lot of these individuals that are in these programs that have neurodevelopmental disorders and are living in assisted housing, as they get older, because we're doing a better job, they need more supports. And where are those supports going to come from? So the government can't look and sort of pigeonhole and say, well, we're going to put more money into education and not look at treatment through health. You can't look at, you know, seniors without looking at mental health. So when we talk about long-term care, or we talk about, you know, living longer within the home, we need to start looking at supportive services that are going to keep that person healthy mentally. Because we've always said mental health is health. I go one step further and always say you can't have health without mental health. And definitely, you know, we need to do more to connect those pieces. So that I'm kind of the basket weaver or the quarterback. I don't know. You use the analogy that you
best. Yeah. And I think so many governments will also be able to learn from what you're going through, the processes that you're going through, and also figure out that it's really not a one size fits all, and you need to understand the different demographics of the people that are in your nation. And I love the fact that you also touched on COVID-19, because so many things are happening. There's so many uncertainties. People are losing jobs, and there's things that have just changed. Life is not as it was before. So there's a study that was done by the government where they put a questionnaire online just to find out how COVID-19 has been impacting people in Canada. And that study showed that over 50% of the participants reported that they've seen an increase in the need for mental health services around them, and their mental health is deteriorating. So what has been government's response to COVID-19 and the increased need of mental health and even addictions in the province of Ontario?
So the statistic pre-COVID was 1 in 5 people have a mental health or an addiction issue in Canada, which is significant when you think of, you know, the number of people in Canada. When the pandemic hit, we had just launched the roadmap to wellness, the plan for mental health in the province of Ontario. I was really excited about it. We had our press conference, and of course, every question had to do with the pandemic and nothing with respect to the work that I'd spent a year
working on.
But what we discovered was a very, very different reality when you have a pandemic. Now, there's crisis management that is part of psychology in terms of what happens to an individual when they're put into a situation where there's crisis. So we've had examples over time of that. So 9/11, I guess, I don't know if it's appropriate, but it's, today happens to be the anniversary of 9/11. And yes. What we learned from that, you know, what we learned from the hurricane and what happened in New Orleans, all of those situations teach us that most people adapt in situations of crisis, and they have mechanisms that allows them to be able to assimilate the experience and to it not really affect them. But a small portion of the population, and it's about 5%, don't have that ability. And we find that in a lot of cases, even children don't have the ability, and there's more prevalency in children, which is dangerous because it leads to complex trauma that then manifests itself later on in life. And in a lot of cases with adults, so, you know, someone losing their job, a woman who has a career, who has children, a spouse or a partner, all of a sudden finds herself at home, having to become a teacher to the kids because they're not going to school, having to look after the household, having to look after business remotely, having to do all these stresses and pressures. And we found, again, with women, 70% of women, 70% in the province, have experienced a mild to moderate depression and anxiety. And we're talking women between the ages of 18 and 54. So we know this, and then it's an issue as well. And as we started to realize we'd better monitor the numbers, because we started to see some increases in suicide. We started to see some increases in relapse rates. And we, in order to understand why you're having the problem, you've got to understand what the underlying issues are. And of course, in a pandemic, which is something we've never experienced before, one of the things that happened is a lot of the healthcare workers that were working in the community groups all went back to the hospital. And so we started losing the ability to have professionals helping people. AA meetings and NA meetings were canceled. Why? Because when you shut down the churches, right, because of COVID, guess what? The basements are shut down as well. And that's where most of the
meetings take place
every week. So all of a sudden, I started really seeing relapse rates increase. And I'm thinking, well, that's really strange. Why? And you find out that it's because of that, because there's no place to meet and the social bubble. And so, you know, how do you fix that problem? So we've learned a lot, and that resulted in the creation of a mental health command table. And it informs health, but it also informs economics and the development of economic activity, so that we understand what we need to do. So we know that restaurant owners and small businesses are suffering. Well, what are we doing as a government to provide supports to those individuals financially, but also mentally? Because if we don't provide those supports mentally, the individuals cannot function. They have difficulty functioning. So what we've learned from the pandemic is that we need to do a lot more work. We need to underscore and understand what happens in a crisis situation and what remedies, what solutions can we put in place. Of course, when everything shuts down and you don't have an internet-based cognitive behavioral therapy model, people aren't getting support anymore. Well, we were working on a program and we launched it very quickly. We invested over $12 million, and I made an announcement just yesterday about additional investments being made in virtual healthcare. And we're discovering that the virtual healthcare through the internet-based cognitive behavioral therapy is having a similar impact on individuals that face-to-face does. And as a result of that, we've invested the additional money because we can help more people. And again, you know, if I had a mental health issue, I mean, I'm very vocal about things. I would certainly say, look, I'm having a problem, you know, anxiety, depression. It's very difficult to get people to say that. But when you have an internet-based program that's confidential, paid for by the government, and allows you access to assessment tools, and then to a therapy that's being monitored by someone who's an expert. So if there's any issues that come up, if anything's flagged, the individual intervenes. The success rate is over 70%. 70% of people that utilize these programs are reporting that they do not have issues of anxiety, depression any longer.
Wow.
And 15% are saying that they feel better. Now, that is a kind of backdrop of other things that we're doing in our strategy. One of the things that we've introduced is structured psychotherapy that we took the concept from England, where it's been running for 13 years. And we've set up a similar system, a parallel system, but it's a face-to-face system. So with internet-based face-to-face, we were building a spectrum of care, one of the best therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, that can be utilized for the bulk of the mental health issues that need to be dealt with. So we're building a system that's addressing that. We're investing a lot of money to go virtual. So that, you know, for instance, in all over the world, we've seen a lot of police intervening in situations that have become, lethal force has been used. And again, in those situations, in many cases, that could have been averted by having what we call mobile intervention crisis teams. So you have a social worker or a nurse practitioner or a psychologist that attends and is the front line at that point to help an individual who has a mental health issue. And you know, we would have seen less violence if we had more of those in place. And again, our strategy here in the province is to build that model to provide. So for instance, when you call 911 and you get the person on the other side of the phone is asking for a police officer to show up, the individual who gets the call can look and listen to the individual and determine whether it's a mental health issue or if it really is an issue that requires police.
Police, yeah. So
by diverting those calls, we avoid the confrontation. And we have the appropriate people looking after the issues in the community. And then, of course, you set up a model that has wraparound services with follow-up by other people that are going to ensure that the individual, for instance, if he's schizophrenic, is taking his medication. Because that, a lot of times, that's what happens. Individuals stop taking their medication. Sometimes they self-medicate. And the result of that is, behaviors that are seen as dangerous or threatening. And unfortunately, that means intervention by the police. Well, if I can get to the individual before and I can make sure that, he's being visited and he's getting the supports he needs and, he or she is being looked after, it'll never come to the point where the police needs to intervene. So the police should be doing policing work, and we should let the people that know what to do when it comes to mental health issues deal with that.
Yeah. And I think introducing virtual spaces to provide care to the public is a very important place and makes it that much more accessible. And I think it's something that can also alleviate some of the stresses that may come with being a frontline worker in the healthcare space, especially during these times of the pandemic. And that leads me to my next question, which is for our frontline heroes. What has the government been doing to ensure that when they are showing up to their jobs, regardless of where they're working, they are able to be their best, like bring their best to the workplace, provide the best service, and also be able to go home and be the best at home, because they might have stresses of, I'm in the front line, I can contract this virus and possibly pass it on to my family. And there's so many things that are going on in their lives, but they still have to be there for the public and give a service that the public needs. So how has government been supporting our frontline heroes?
Yeah, and that's a fantastic question. So Boosie, I'm not sure if you know this, but I was a Solicitor General. Back then it was called Community Safety and Corrections. So I was the minister responsible for the police, firefighters, corrections officers in the province of Ontario. And one of the things I learned, because I used to do a lot of night rides, I used to do a lot of meetings with the frontline workers to understand what needed to be done. And it was distressing to me to see that very little had been done in the past with training when they're at school, by police college. Very little was being done to give them supports during the work time. And I met a lot of people that broke down as a result of complex trauma and PTSD. So our government recognized it from the very beginning, from when we were elected. And our premier made it very clear that we're going to provide supports to our frontline workers on two fronts. One, to ensure that they are healthy. And two, that when they are confronted with a situation that has a mental health component, that they're best able to deal with it, to stabilize, so that to de-escalate it and then turn it over to people that can help the individual. So our government, early on, when I mentioned the $12 million that was initially invested, we worked on developing a therapy and a helpline specifically for first responders. And we're continuing to invest in that so that first responders, while we have this situation, are able to get virtual support. And again, it's very helpful and has been very successful. We are making more investments in terms of providing more tools to the police officers, not to be police, but to understand how to de-escalate and turn the problem over to the mental health care workers. And again, I am a huge, huge supporter of the police. It's unfortunate that circumstances arise where there is confusion as to the reason behind the call. But I think the way we fix that is by investing money in providing the supports that are needed, which is more mental health care workers helping individuals in the community and helping police officers identify the difference. You know, in a lot of the cases, and I can't get into a lot of the details, but a lot of the cases I get the reports, and it's a misinterpretation. Older police officers, I guess because of their street sense, because of their training, not so much training, but experience, are less likely to draw their guns. The younger police officers, I think it's because of lack of experience. I don't think there's a police officer that is intentionally looking, well, there's always the exception, but the majority of our police officers are there to serve and protect all citizens. And I think what we need to do is better define their role by providing the appropriate supports to do a separation of responsibilities. And I think that in the long run, it's going to hold itself to be the right answer in the situation. You know, police officers, there's always going to be an element of criminality, but the majority of people aren't, you know, it's a small percentage. And where that line, where the transition is, where, you know, it's something to do with mental health. I mean, we all have a bad day. And so if you walk out and the police officer hears you yelling and screaming and sharing, you know, and kicking your car, it's a bad day. It's not necessarily, and we all, I mean, you mentioned it before about mental health and addictions. We all have mental health issues. I have mental health issues. There are days that I get up and, you know what, I'd rather stay in bed. But, you know, you learn mechanisms to make you feel focus and be able to move forward. Yeah. Anxiety, you know, if you don't feel anxiety to a certain extent, you know, I'm sitting here having a chat with you. Well, I'm a little anxious because I don't know what kind of questions you're going to ask. I don't know where we're going. So, you know, but that's healthy, right? A little anxiety is healthy. When it becomes overwhelming, though, people have to know that there's help for them. They have to know they can reach out. And again, I'm really big on building therapeutic alliances with individuals on the basis of understanding each other. It's very difficult for me to sit across from a Black man and try to help him not having lived or walked in his shoes. So I'm more interested in finding a Black man who can be empathetic to the issues that a Black person has and providing him the resources to be, or her the resources to help that individual. And that goes for every community.
Yeah.
Every community. I think that's the way it needs to be, because it's easier for a Black person to build a therapeutic alliance with another Black person, or Indigenous to another Indigenous person. And we lose precious minutes, precious hours, when we try to build that alliance. You know, again, there are specialists that are able to do it, and that's fantastic. But I think the right answer to do is let's invest in people. Let's invest in the Black community to get more psychologists and psychiatrists. Let's do that with the Indigenous people of our country. Let's do that with, you know, people that understand neurodevelopmental disorders, because they then are best able to understand the needs and inform governments as to how investments should be made.
Should be made, yeah.
Yeah.
Your office is doing really incredible work, and you are constantly on the go, moving from meeting to meeting, having commitments that you need to fulfill. My last question for you is, how does MPP Tebolo take care of himself? How do you take care of yourself?
If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see that I have a few hobbies. One of my hobbies is beekeeping. So I have 54 beehives, and I spend my free time, if I can squeeze it in. Bees are very industrious and very self. They don't need a lot of care. You just have to be there at certain times to make sure that you give them, you know, if they need the water because of a dry period, or during the period of time that there aren't flowers, that you feed them, and then you winterize them. There's a few things you need to do. So that's one of my hobbies. The other one that you probably will find funny is I grow hot peppers. So I grow everything from, I'm not interested. I have a few lighter, maybe 5,000-7,000 Scoville type peppers that I kind of like, just kind of enjoy with dinner. Yeah. But I have peppers starting at 50,000 Scoville, going to 2.5 million. So that is the hottest plant, the hottest pepper. So Scotch bonnet, ghost peppers, you name it, I've got pretty well every color and variety. There's about 150 of them that I grow. And so that's what I do. I'll go to my backyard, I'll turn on the hose, and I'll go out and water all these pepper plants every night. And that gives me a time to reflect. It yeah. gives me time to, be spiritual. And spiritual, I don't mean religious. By spiritual, I mean, staying in tune with nature, staying in tune with, balance and equilibrium, which is something you see if you take the time in nature every day with, everybody having a purpose and a function, insects, plants, the flowers. So that's what I do. Those are the two main things that kind of keep me focused and allow me a distraction to let my brain go into neutral and let what's stored in there sort of come up to the top so I can address those issues.
That is so beautiful. That is really, really beautiful. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
I really enjoyed our chat.
Anytime. I'm always here. If there's anything that you want to talk about, again in the future, I'm more than happy to do so. I think, and you're playing a really important role in what you do, because I think every time we talk about mental health, it opens the possibility of one person
definitely
saying, I need to talk to someone.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I even started this platform, because I realized that the more we talk about it, the more people realize I'm not going through things alone. There right. are other people who are also facing the same issues that I am, and they can find ways and things that could potentially help them. So, yeah.
So I appreciate the work you're doing. That's why when you mentioned what you're doing, I kind of perked up and said, okay, I got to get there, because I want to share the message that there is help. You're not alone. And there's lots of things that we can do. And believe me, the sun comes up every day. We may not see it, right? We may be on one of those gray, miserable days like today. But the sun rose this morning, and the sun is shining somewhere. And there's a beautiful, sunrise somewhere. And there'll be a beautiful sunset tonight. And that's what life is all about. We've got to accept the fact that, you're not always going to have a sunrise or a sunset. But you got to remember that it's there and it will come back. And that's like our mental health. We know we're resilient. We know, we're human beings. We've survived so much. We've gone through so much. It's important to remember that the sun will shine tomorrow and you'll feel better tomorrow. And, there's people that will help you get there if you can't do it by yourself.
Definitely. Thank you so much, MP Peter Borlo.
My pleasure. All the best.
Thank you for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. My name is Boosie, and I thank you once again for listening.